Iran says its agreement with the IAEA on the installation of new cameras at Karaj centrifuge facility is a goodwill gesture after the agency condemned an act of sabotage there. Syria confronts an Israeli missile strike. The attack claims the life of a soldier while the air defenses intercept most of the missiles. Also coming up, the Yemeni army says its ballistic missiles have hit vital targets, including an airbase in the southern Saudi cities of Jizan and Khamis Umshayyat. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story for this hour. Iran says it won't accept any proposal in the Vienna talks that go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has told the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres that Tehran is ready to negotiate a good deal. Iran's top diplomat has blamed the slow progress in the talks on the other signatories' lack of initiative, while noting that threats have never worked in the case of Iran. Amir Abdullahian says Iran has allowed cameras to be replaced at its Karaj centrifuge complex after the UN nuclear watchdog denounced a sabotage attack there. He described the move as Iran's goodwill gesture. Guterres, for his part, has voiced support for the process in the Vienna to revive the JCPOA.
Iran and the UN Atomic Agency have reached a deal concerning the IAEA's inspection of a centrifuge facility. Tehran has agreed to let the watchdog replace damaged cameras at its site in Karaj. The International Atomic Energy Agency has been seeking to replace the devices which were damaged in a sabotage attack in June, which Iran blames on Israel. The issue was discussed during IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi's two trips to Tehran in recent months, but no agreement could be reached. The IAEA touted the agreement as an important development for its verification and monitoring activities in Iran. It also hoped that the two sides would continue to work to resolve remaining safeguard issues. Iran's foreign minister, for his part, called it a good agreement to ease alleged concerns over the country's peaceful nuclear activities. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the agreement would boost cooperation between Tehran and the agency, despite the fact that the IAEA has occasionally taken politically motivated decisions regarding Iran.
Unfortunately, as Iran told Mr. Grossi during his recent trip to Tehran, the agency is substantially deviating from its mission. The agency sometimes focuses on political issues instead of focusing on technical issues, and this creates problems concerning cooperation between the IAEA and Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. In recent days, we faced the same problem. The agency used technical tools to wield political influence on the Vienna talks.
The announcement comes as Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are busy discussing how to revive the accord, which the U.S. withdrew unilaterally in 2018. Iran says it wants the removal of all sanctions inconsistent with the JCPOA in a verifiable manner. Tehran also wants a firm guarantee that Washington would not quit the deal ever again.
Israel has carried out yet another missile strike against Syrian positions in the country's south, killing one soldier. Syrian media are quoting a military source as saying that the aerial attacks were launched from the occupied Golan Heights. According to the source, the Syrian defense systems have intercepted most of the missiles. The assault has also caused some material damage there. Israel frequently launches airstrikes on Syria. Damascus has repeatedly condemned the attacks as a violation of its sovereignty and filed complaints to the United Nations. Over 24 more Palestinians become homeless as the Israeli regime forces them to leave their ancestral homes in occupied East Al-Quds. A family of 27 in the Sinwar neighborhood has been targeted this time. They were pressed by the regime's officials to leave and demolish their own homes. Many of those left homeless include children and the elderly. On Tuesday, Israeli forces bulldozed the remains of a Palestinian house in the same neighborhood. Some of the Palestinians whose homes are subject to demolition raised them themselves to avoid further penalties. The Israeli regime regularly flattens Palestinian homes and structures in Al-Quds under the pretext that they lack building permits. But Palestinians and right groups say the moves are aimed at grabbing more Palestinian land to expand its settlements, which are all illegal under international law. Political commentator Rabab Abdul Hadi believes Israel's ultimate goal is to clear Al-Quds, occupied Al-Quds, from Palestinians and claim the city as its eternal capital.
It is a very sad situation. It's a crime against humanity, and let's call it what it is. It's a crime against humanity, it's a collective punishment, and it is a project of settler colonial regime that tries to erase the indigenous people of the land in order to replace them with immigrants from all over the world and claim that the land is not theirs. The reality of the matter is that Palestinians have been enduring this treatment for a very long time. Actually, even Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel themselves are also oftentimes forced to raise their own homes. It costs at least $150,000 to raise the home, and then they also sometimes have to pay for the Israeli helicopters and the dogs that come along with the Israeli military establishment to destroy Palestinian homes. This is nothing more than, it is a crime against humanity, it's a violation of human rights, it's actually making people homeless in their own homes. And what Israel is trying to do by this is to actually empty Jerusalem from Palestinians, Judaize Jerusalem, take it over and claim that it is the eternal capital of Israel.
Moving on, the Yemeni army says it has carried out a large-scale operation in southwestern Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's deadly assaults and ongoing siege. The army spokesman says a barrage of ballistic missiles has accurately hit vital targets in the city of Jizan as warplane hangars at King Khalid Air Base near the city of Khamis Mshayed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia says it has intercepted two ballistic missiles over the southern city of Abha. Riyadh, along with some of its Arab allies, launched a military campaign against Yemen in March 2015. The war has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and plunged Yemen into what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says recent operations against Saudi Arabia show that the Yemenis now have the upper hand in the war.
We have seen in the recent last 2-3 years, Yemeni army has launched many attacks using sometimes up to 40 ballistic missiles and drones and as well other missiles, like the attack that happened about a week ago. And it showed exactly that the war against Yemen has actually failed. And Yahya Sari, the spokesperson, have said that the Yemeni army is ready to launch a bigger and broader attack against Saudi Arabia if they are not going to stop their war and their crime committed against Yemeni civilians, and if they are not going to lift the blockade. And at this point, Yemeni army is the one who have in the upper hand. They are advancing toward and controlling and liberating many areas around the Marib city. This war actually has exposed Saudi Arabia, and it shows how weak is this coalition, even though it's supported by United States, UK, and France. But it showed that Yemeni resistance actually is the one that actually will win, and they are advancing on the ground, they are launching attack, they are targeting shooting down Saudi fighter jet and drones as well. This shows that now the upper hand is for the Yemeni army.
Turning elsewhere, the U.S. Congress votes to launch a commission to study failures of the 20-year war it launched in Afghanistan that came to an end with a chaotic withdrawal of American troops last summer. The panel is part of a $768 billion annual defense package passed by the Senate, 89-10. The Commission on America's Longest War will have 16 members. It has to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting and a final one in 3 years. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 led to the ouster of the Taliban, but the group rose to power again in August after 20 years as foreign forces were leaving the war-torn country. According to the U.S. Defense Department, the war has cost American taxpayers some $955 billion. Britain has recorded more than 78,000 COVID-19 infections. That's the highest daily tally since the start of the pandemic. The UK also registered 165 more COVID-related deaths in the last 24 hours. The rise in coronavirus infections is being largely attributed to the spread of the Omicron variant. Health officials have warned of a staggering increase in cases over the next few days. They also say the sheer numbers of infections could lead to mounting fatalities and an overwhelmed healthcare system. The French army has left northern Mali following 9 years of war. The retreat was preceded by thousands of deaths and over a million refugees. Massive protests in France's former colony are credited with forcing the withdrawal. Rami Mazahari reports from Paris.
France has withdrawn from northern Mali and the historic city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or even French Parliament. Mali initially became destabilized in 2011 following France's illegal arms drops to anti-Qaddafi militants in Libya. The arms were then used by Tuareg separatists who have demanded more rights ever since colonial France first dictated Mali's peculiar bow-tie-shaped borders. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. There have been two military coups in little over a year, while increasing demonstrations against France's presence could no longer be ignored or sufficiently repressed.
It's very difficult for France to justify its presence, even more so because the people of Mali, who are neither Tuareg nor Islamists, have been protesting France's presence in the country. So what the Malians want is not really very clear, except the fact that they want the French gone.
The war has been so ineffectual that Malians openly accuse France of arming the rebels, while the conflict is often dubbed France's Afghanistan. Paris has blamed Russian disinformation for turning Malian public opinion against France, but polls in the capital, Bamako, have shown that 80% of respondents believe that France is only in Mali to defend French interests.
France's failed war in Mali has been even more degrading to its image at home and abroad than their failed involvement in Afghanistan. The war has been routinely cited by terrorists as justification for attacks in France.
France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of their former colonies gained nominal independence. Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of natural resources.
It's believed that Mali has some very important resources that have yet to be tapped, like neighboring Niger, which is rich in uranium. And once again, let's not forget, France gets nearly 80% of its energy from nuclear power. So uranium is an important asset for the French. But it would be difficult for France to say, yeah, we're going to stay in Mali because there's this potential uranium deposit, plus the gold, plus this, plus that, etc.
Analysts say that it's premature to call it the end of the war, but that France is entering into a new phase of the war. France will retain a 3,000-strong army to roam the Sahel region. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
Turning elsewhere now, Nigeria's senior Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki defends the Islamic movement in Nigeria, noting that his sole mission is to raise people's awareness. Danjuma Abdullahi is in Abuja.
Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki says the Islamic movement aims to raise awareness about Islam. He says malevolent intent is behind the allegations that the IMN is an association. He asked the media to stop referring to his supporters as if they are members of an organization, explaining that they are just activists.
We don't have membership card. Right. We don't register to become part of this. Once you are active, you are just active. That's all. It's open for all Muslims, not only Muslims. It is open even to non-Muslims. You may know that, maybe you don't know. There is Christian forum of the Islamic movement. What happened?
Sheikh Zazaki said many Nigerians have marked the 6th anniversary of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds of his supporters were murdered in cold blood by security forces. He said the extent of the heinous crimes committed during the massacre is beyond comprehension, as the attack was completely unprovoked.
We are running a kind of hospital in that Husseinia, the center. They murdered all the patients and all the nurses and all the doctors. Over 1,000 people were murdered in 3 days. And they all carried all their bodies and dumped them in different mass graves. Even a dead person has a right to be buried according to his religious belief.
Nigerians from diverse cultural backgrounds convened to attend the public lecture to mark the 6th anniversary of the massacre. The hearing for a suit challenging the confiscation of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife's passports will be held on January 18th.
Meanwhile, the Islamic cleric said he will have to stay with a dangerous bullet shrapnel in his body. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned. This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The House of Representatives Committee laid out its case for a contempt of Congress charge against Mark Meadows, the chief of staff of former President Donald J. Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Emily Cochrane. The piece is titled, "Meadows was deeply involved in fighting election outcome," January 6th panel says. The House Committee investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol released a report on Sunday, 12th of December, that laid out its case for a contempt of Congress charge against Mark Meadows, the chief of staff to former President Donald J. Trump, presenting evidence of Mr. Meadows' deep involvement in the effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. In the 51-page document, the House committee said it wanted to question Mark Meadows about an email he had sent a day before the attack, advising that the National Guard would be used to defend Trump supporters. The House panel said it also wants to ask him about an exchange with an unnamed senator about rejecting electors for Joseph R. Biden Jr. Mark Meadows had been cooperating with the committee's investigation, but he refused to appear for a scheduled deposition last week or to turn over additional documents, citing Donald Trump's assertion of executive privilege. The House committee, which is controlled by Democrats, is slated to vote on Monday to recommend a contempt of Congress charge against him for his refusal to cooperate with its subpoena. That charge carries a penalty of up to a year in jail. Before coming to loggerheads with the House panel, Mark Meadows provided more than 9,000 pages of records to the committee. The information they contained raised additional questions, the panel said. Among the emails and text messages that Mark Meadows turned over were the following, the House panel said. A 7th of November email that discussed an attempt to arrange with state legislators to appoint slates of pro-Trump electors instead of the Biden electors chosen by the voters. Mr. Meadows's text messages also showed him asking members of Congress how to put Donald Trump in contact with slate legislators. Text messages Mark Meadows exchanged with an unidentified senator in which he recounted Donald Trump's view on Vice President Mike Pence's ability to reject electors from certain states. Donald Trump thinks the legislators have the power, but the vice president has power too, Mr. Meadows wrote. A 5th of January email in which Mark Meadows said the National Guard would be present at the Capitol on 6th of January to protect pro-Trump people. Emails from Mr. Meadows to Justice Department officials on 29th of December, 30th of December, and 1st of January, in which he encouraged investigators of voter fraud, including allegations already rejected by federal investigators and by courts of law. Text messages Mark Meadows exchanged with members of Congress as violence engulfed the Capitol on 6th of January, in which lawmakers encouraged him to persuade Donald Trump to discourage the attack, as well as a text message sent to one of the president's family members in which Mark Meadows said he was pushing hard for Donald Trump to condemn this. Text messages reflecting Mr. Meadows' private skepticism about some of the wild public statements about allegations of widespread election fraud and compromised voting machines that were put forth by Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell is a lawyer working with Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. The committee also said it had a number of questions prompted by Mr. Meadows' new book, The Chief's Chief, and cited it as evidence that his refusal to testify was untenable. Mr. Meadows has shown his willingness to talk about issues related to the Select Committee's investigation across a variety of media platforms, anywhere it seems, except to the Select Committee, the panel wrote. The House Committee said it also had questions about why Mr. Meadows had used a personal cell phone, a Signal account, and two personal Gmail accounts to conduct official business, and whether he had properly turned over all records from those accounts to the National Archives. The report comes as the committee is scrutinizing a 38-page PowerPoint document containing plans to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. That document, which Mark Meadows provided to the committee, urged Donald Trump to declare a national emergency, to cling to power, and included an unsupported claim that China and Venezuela had obtained control over the voting infrastructure in a majority of U.S. states. Mark Meadows' lawyer has said he provided the document to the committee because he had received it by email and did nothing with it. Phil Waldron, a retired Army colonel who has promoted false claims of election fraud, said that he had circulated the document among Donald Trump's allies and among lawmakers on Capitol Hill in the days just before the mob violence on 6th of January. Rudolph Giuliani has identified Mr. Waldron as a source of information for his legal campaign. Phil Waldron told the Washington Post that he had visited the White House several times after last year's election and spoken with Mark Meadows maybe 8 to 10 times.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and let us contemplate on what the Prophet of Islam has said about the kinds of hands that human beings have. Hands are of three types: the begging hand, the giving hand, and the grasping hand. The best of hands is the giving hand.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: power. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of power and its impact on the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the word power in the Islamic context, we see that in the Islamic context, when it is said about the power, it means that a person who has the power, he lives with chastity, he lives with love, and the power means not to misuse the power that you have. The power means to use power under the surveillance of the justice, under the surveillance of the love. And the power in the Islamic text is used like when you can use your power to show others, it is where you're defending yourself. In the defense, you need to show your power, or for example, you need to show your power so that the enemies cannot attack you. They should know that you have your own rights, you have the power of defending yourself, and you have the power of eliminating any enemy that will attack you. Therefore, when we talk in Islam about the power, this power means that it's for your defense. So when you show your power, it is to defend yourself from the invasion of the others so that no one can invade your country, your house, your respect. And that's what, when we look at the Islamic text, we found these things under the topic of power. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of power under the context of Islamic teachings. And we see that in the Islamic lifestyle, when we talk about the power, this power does not mean oppressing others. This power does not mean to invade other countries. This power does not mean to misuse your ability or this power that you have. This means that you use your power in order to facilitate other people. We use, in Islamic lifestyle, we use power to facilitate other people, to help the oppressed ones, to help the needy ones, and to protect ourselves. This is what power basically refers in the Islamic lifestyle when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle. So even in many of the narrations, we have the same meaning. And also, when we talk about the power in Islam, Islam says not to misuse the power, because if someone uses or if someone misuses the power, then obviously he is not following the true path of Islam. So someone should not use it as a trick. So we do not have the permission of using power or misusing the power. Let's say like this. We do not have the permission of misusing the power in order to show ourselves to the others. Therefore, it is very important. It is very important to follow the righteous path which is set in the Islam. And the ones who are following the Islamic lifestyle, who wants to have the Islamic lifestyle, remember, the power that Allah has given to you, it's a blessing. It is a trust which Allah has given you. So use it under the justice, use it with the justice, with the love, and for the sake of betterment of the society, and not to just something which you have personally or to show off yourself, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Scientists in Brazil have come up with a creative way to shore up the population of a majestic species of monkeys in danger of extinction. Brazilian conservationists have constructed a bridge to reconnect the two sides of Rio de Janeiro's Atlantic forest. The road had effectively isolated a group of lion tamarins, but now it offers hope for the endangered monkey. There are only 2,500 golden tamarins left in the wild, all of them in Brazil. It is estimated that these animals have lost more than 95% of their habitat.
As people around the globe are preparing for the New Year holidays, the Vatican lights up a Christmas tree and nativity scene set up on St. Peter's Square. People gathered around the square waiting for long hours to see the illumination. Even heavy rain did not stop them. That's while the official lighting ceremony was held inside of Hall 6 Hall, where Pope Francis presides his weekly audiences. The nativity scene, made of more than 30 pieces, is created by Peruvian artists. The majestic Christmas tree is about 28 meters and comes from Andalo, northern Italy. The locals see the stunning tree as a symbol of hope and peace. The tree will be switched on every night until January the 6th.
Childhood joy and lightness meet with art at a first-of-its-kind museum in Rome, Italy. Here, all kinds of art decorations are made of balloons. The exhibit dubbed Let's Fly displays a broad range of interactive artworks. In one installation, visitors are invited to find their inner child by diving into a pool of hundreds of small balloons. In another section, giant inflatable sculptures double as a playground for kids. Some installations move only by riding a bicycle. The museum is a place where artists and spectators coexist for a journey into a world of inflatable art capable of freeing the imagination of all ages.
It's the combination of art with childhood and adolescence that makes this place so magical. So they are art installations, but also games. The blurred line between the two is what makes the museum so unique.
The balloon exhibit incorporates innovative works created by 14 different artists from across Europe. The artifacts were created using hundreds of thousands of biodegradable balloons. Organizers say they want to increase environmental awareness by being eco-friendly, as all the artworks will be reused or recycled. The exhibit will run until March the 5th.
Chinese students receive a science lesson on their country's space station, and they are lucky enough to receive it firsthand from the astronauts living in the first and core module of the station. The class was held via a live broadcast shown on state television. The three astronauts gave a lecture that focused on physics. They explained how the weightlessness environment affects the movement of objects. The astronauts also gave a tour of the station they arrived at in October for a six-month stay. It seems that their teachings were quite motivating. The students peppered their instructors with questions, including those about living conditions in space. China launched its space station in April and plans to complete it by the end of the next year. Christmas is just around the corner, and children are waiting for their presents. In Guatemala, Santa Claus has a new mode of transport to give gifts to children with cancer.
Today, as in the past year, we are celebrating Christmas with the cancer patients of the shelter. Santa Claus came in a helicopter to give presents to the children. It is very emotional for the children. The majority of them have never been so close to a helicopter, let alone Santa Claus.
That was an exciting experience for the children. The charity event was organized by an institute that supports cancer patients for remote areas in Guatemala. The institute says the event aimed to help the children go through their therapies with more ease. The Amazon River turtles are in danger of extinction, but environmentalists have come up with an initiative to save their lives. And that's by protecting their eggs. Climate change and human activities against their ecosystem have been putting these creatures at risk. Now, what the biologists and local volunteers do is that they recover the turtle nests from riverbanks during the rainy season to protect them from drowning. Then they take care of the baby turtles until they develop a hard shell and are ready to start their life journey. Batches of tiny turtles release into a river in the Amazon border between Bolivia and Brazil. They are now grown enough to protect themselves against different threats. Environmentalists have been doing this for more than 20 years, saving millions of baby turtles. This time they released 1 million of the little turtles. During the Christmas season, people around the world love to add a dose of joy in the form of Santas. Children especially feel ecstatic to see Santas distributing presents and snacks. But you will be amazed to see how one Santa this time dives into water to give well-behaved sharks and fishes their goodies. In Malta's National Aquarium, Scuba Claus, helped by an elf, plunges into a huge fish tank with his sack of treats to feed sharks and fishes. Santa's ho-ho-ho come out in bubble through his snorkel over his white beard. The aquarium, located in the northern part of the island, hosts more than 175 different species of various marine animals.
Butterflies are probably the most popular among all insect species on Earth due to their beauty and color. Millions of the monarch butterflies have flocked to a Mexican forest, creating a magical sight, drawing tourists, scientists, and locals there. The monarch butterflies flee the cold winters of Canada and northern United States and travel thousands of kilometers to hibernate and reproduce in the temperate woods of central Mexico. Hundreds of trees crowded with butterflies can be seen along Mexico's 13,000-hectare Monarch Reserve after their long journey. However, experts warn of a drop in the number of the species. Climate change is reported to have had an impact on their butterflies' migration pattern, as well as a reduction in their milkweed breeding habitat in the United States.
The line is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
With the Christmas season in full swing, hundreds have gathered on Spain's Gran Canaria island to watch stunning sand sculptures representing the birth of Christ. 8 sand artists from around the world have created the spectacular figures. It took them a week to complete the scenes. A huge sand wall is built around the sculptures to protect them. The island has been holding the event every year since 2006. The warm temperatures on the Spanish beach have helped attract a lot of visitors over Christmas. According to the organizers, at least 200,000 people have visited the exhibition in the past 15 years. A joyful day at an Australian zoo as a baby pygmy hippo is born. That's good news for the zoo staff because pygmy hippos are endangered species. Kambiri, the mother hippo, gave birth to the calf last month. It's her second calf and the first one was born in a Sydney zoo 4 years ago. The newborn is yet to be named. It sticks to the mum and follows her wherever she goes. The calf is spending most of its time out of the sight of the public, as for now it's learning to walk and swim. And the mum keeps a close eye on the calf at all times.
The first few days, she did not leave the calf's side, was very sedate, very quiet, and just looking after its every need. And only in the last sort of couple of days has she started to get a little bit more sleep in.
They are regarded as endangered animals because of illegal hunting and loss of habitat. Currently, less than 3,000 pygmy hippos are living in the wild.
Is it interesting to experience what Harry Potter went through at Hogwarts? Well, it could be, at least from students at a university in Pakistan kicking off a festival celebrating the fictional wizard. The students at Government College University made their 150-year-old campus look like the magical school created by British author J.K. Rowling. They put on costumes and set up decorations reminiscent of Hogwarts. The university's vice chancellor says the campus, with its vast halls and soaring archways, has always reminded the students of the fictional school.
Most of these youngsters, they grew up at the time when J.K. Rowling's work was being presented in the novels and then later on in the film. So that magical charm, that fantasy, they really enjoyed. They grew up reading that fantasy. And then when they come to Government College University and see these architecture, it reminds me of that Hogwarts that is being filmed in Harry Potter films.
The university official spoke proudly of what his students have done. They were themselves happy too, calling their experience fun. Others said it was unbelievable to be in Hogwarts. The festival also screened Pakistan's first fan-made Harry Potter film made and acted by the students. The Swedish city of Stockholm has launched its 31st annual Christmas competition of baking gingerbread.
There is a limited in space, so it's 40 centimeters by 40 centimeters, and everything you build, all the material need to be eatable. So you can build with different things, gingerbread of course, but also candies and other things, but you need to be able to eat it. So that's one of the rules as well.
Each year, the Gingerbread House competition, hosted by ArcDesk Museum of Architecture and Design, has a theme for the designs. This year's theme is Together, attracting various interpretations of the topic. So far, the entries have included the Titanic, the famous coffee shop from the American TV show Friends, an igloo and the Berlin Wall, all entirely edible. The event, which has been running for 31 years, is designed for all kinds of creators, such as children, young people, adults, amateurs, and professionals. The Tasty exhibition runs until January the 5th. A Palestinian teacher has developed an assistant for himself nicknamed Mr. Robot, bringing joy to the children of a school in Gaza. Mr. Robot teaches the children of Albusma School about electric circuits and helps them memorize their lessons. Mr. Robot moves freely in the classroom, speaking Arabic to students and communicating with them as a friend. The teacher creating it says the aim was to stimulate creativity and innovation in his classroom.
Mr. Robot, as his name suggests, is the teacher's assistant and not his replacement. He assists in the education process by asking questions and giving answers, greeting students and interacting with them in all aspects of a class.
The teacher says at first students reacted to it in a strange way, but later on they said it was like a dream come true for them. Local engineers say the robot is the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, where electrical tools and components are scarce.
Artificial intelligence has found its way into several aspects of our lives. Now, a French research team is working on a project to provide fishermen with intelligent trawls that could help them sort out fishes before they are brought to the boats.
The objective of the project is to try to provide a support tool for fishermen, because at the moment, when they put their fishing gear in the water, a trawl net is like a large net. It is towed behind the vessel for several hours without having knowledge of what enters the trawl net in real time. Namely, is it species that are targeted by the fishermen or not targeted?
The trawl has a camera that can capture footage underwater, which is then analyzed by a microcomputer using artificial intelligence. If targeted fishes are detected, the trawl will switch to fishing mode, but when there are no targeted species, it will switch back to flight mode to avoid having an impact on the seabed. Another feature of this technology is to identify and classify pelagic species. For instance, horse mackerel can be displayed in blue on the screen, while the sardines are shown in pink.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight.
Vital visits to look after people with dementia and other disabilities are being denied amid rising demand in the United Kingdom, including families concerned about sending their loved ones to care homes during the pandemic, and staff shortages triggered by low pay and Brexit. We now present you an article written jointly by Robert Booth and Maya Wolf-Robinson. The piece is titled, Operators Say Home Care Services Crisis in England at Worst Point Yet. Operators have warned services that look after the elderly and disabled at home are facing the worst crisis in memory, with hours of unmet care in England increasing more than fivefold since May to 1.5 million. Vital visits to look after people with dementia and other disabilities are being denied amid rising demand, including families concerned about sending their loved ones to care homes during the pandemic, and staff shortages triggered by low pay and Brexit. According to the Home Care Association, about half of domiciliary care providers are no longer able to take on new requests for help, and 85% of operators believe the situation is the hardest it has ever been. The charity Age UK has warned of the emergence of care deserts, a term more often applied to US healthcare shortages. The crisis threatens the welfare of some of the country's most vulnerable people and puts pressure on NHS beds, as people could be cared for in the community end up in hospital. Families told The Guardian that people feel imprisoned if carers are not available to take them outside, while their health is harmed because they forget to eat, they forget to drink or take medicine properly and on time. Jane Towson, the chief executive of Home Care Association, said, "Our strategy seems to be to neglect people in the community until they are in crisis, then blue light them into hospital." She added, "Then it is the devil's own job to get them out again because of a lack of capacity." The Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, ADAS, found that in the 3 months to the end of April, 286,000 hours of home care could not be delivered. By the end of October, that number stood at more than 1.5 million hours. Councils have managed to increase the number of hours delivered by 20% over that period, but it has not been close to enough. Stephen Chandler, the president of the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, ADAS, said, "These are not numbers, these are people's lives. Every single one is a person who is missing out on vital support that enables them to live their lives. The government must make immediate steps to ensure that everyone gets the care and support that they need this winter." Margaret McCann, an 81-year-old with dementia living alone in Brighton in East Sussex, is among those caught in the crisis. "In June, she stopped eating and forgot to drink and take medication, and a crisis care team from Age UK stepped in temporarily until her family hoped a home care package from the local council could be arranged. 6 months later, the only professional care she receives is from the crisis team, which was supposed to stop after just 6 weeks. Her daughter, Sally McCann, who has a full-time job and a son aged 17 years, said, "She has dementia and lives on her own, which is a massive worry." She adds, "She is basically on her own and is losing all her social contact. It breaks my heart. The emphasis is on keeping everyone at home, but they will just deteriorate unless there is help." On a short visit recently, Margaret, who remains sprightly at times, held hands with her carer, Trevor Thew, and told him, "I'm nearly 82 years old, you know." He asked, "What's your secret?" She said, "I've forgotten," adding, "I tell you next time you come." Brighton and Hove City Council said it has seen a fivefold increase in demand in the last year, with families increasingly reluctant to send their loved ones into care homes. It said Brexit has hit providers' attempts to find enough staff. Sue Shanks, the chair of Council's Health and Wellbeing Board, said social care services, including home care, desperately need more government funding quickly if we are going to continue to fully meet the needs of our residents. In Salford, in the city